It's a freedom machine like no other, starting, growing, and cashing out of your own business.
Then all hell breaks loose.
Burned out, carrying all the weight on your shoulders, fighting fire after fire, never getting a break. But that was so yesterday.
It's time for your business breakthrough. Break out of the bottleneck. Break through to new levels of success. And break into a life you love. Now from Park Avenue in New York City, here's attorney, strategist, and SBA small business champion, Nina Kaufman. This is the Business Breakthrough Podcast.
Hello, how are you? Welcome to Business Breakthrough. I'm your host, Nina Kaufman, coming to you from the heart of New York City, and I'm glad you're here today. Thanks for tuning in. In this episode, we're going to chat with J.C. Maldonado III. He is the CEO of BizGrow Partners, a full-service business development firm, about what buyers want when they're acquiring a business. And I wanted to have him on the show because, and you probably heard the Stephen Covey expression, begin with the end in mind. Well, often business owners don't do that. They begin with the beginning in mind, not necessarily the end. So they may spend a lot of years working in their business and reach a point where they say, okay, I think I'm ready to cash out. But they've got, I don't know, sugar plums and uniforms and sparkly bits in their head about what their business is worth. And sometimes it's worth less than they think, especially if they haven't found a way to enable the business to function without them, if they haven't found a way to make it scale. So if all you've done is create a job for yourself and, you know, maybe a handful of others, you may not be getting what you expect. So, you know, the same way Freud asked, what do women want? I wanted to look at what do buyers want so that we as business owners can be prepared. So, you know, what is it that makes our company attractive to someone else? What is it that makes it valuable enough that people will part with the kind of dollar signs that we would like to see? So when you know from both sides of the table what people are looking for, you can really be prepared. And it may not be today's task or tomorrow's task, but really it's to plant a seed, the same kind of seeds that we plant in our 10 Steps to $1 Million business report. Because if you don't have a brain trust to help you put the financials and other aspects of this business planning together, you may find yourself stuck with no one to sell to when you're ready to exit, or being forced to stay on for a longer transition. And ultimately, you're not going to be able to cash out for what you thought you could get. And that puts a real damper on your financial position. So make sure to go to businessexponential.com/podreport. To get your copy. And ultimately, what you want is to create a strong foundation for your business in a way that it can ultimately function without you. And that's what I'm looking forward to drilling down into and discussing with our guest this week. So a little bit about J.C. Maldonado III. J.C. He is the CEO of BizGrow Partners. They're a full-service business development firm. The company was originally founded in 2000, really focusing on mergers and acquisitions, being an intermediary that helps small and middle market companies buy and sell other companies. But that changed because JC and his partners saw that their clients needed a wider range of services, and also that baby boomer owners were more apt to hold on to their companies and to expand them instead of just exiting and retiring. JC also has over a decade of experience in the investment banking, buy-sell transaction arena, as well as a lot of experience training, motivating, and managing salespeople. JC has a JD from Fordham University, although he chose to leave the dark side and go into business instead of practicing law. We're delighted to have him here on Business Breakthrough. Hey, JC, thanks for being with us today.
How's everything, Nina?
Everything is great. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation about looking at what buyers want. You know, it almost sounds like, well, you know, when Freud asked, what do women want? Well, what do buyers want when they're acquiring a business, so that we can kind of reverse engineer that success? And first, what I would love for you to touch on are really the two main ways that businesses grow.
The two ways in terms of how in general or how we grow them here at my company?
No, just in general, because I think it's useful for people to understand.
Well, from my standpoint, I think there are three processes in which a business has to kind of look at. So I think on one front, they have to look at their sales and marketing. So marketing's job is to generate qualified leads to that business. That's what essentially, in my mind, marketing is about. And sales, the role of sales is to convert those leads into actual revenue dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one phase of the business. So, you know, and what that does is that creates the revenue that the business actually needs to achieve in order to produce a profit. Now, the second phase that a business has to now kind of concentrate on is the delivery of that actual service. So let's call that operations or client fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole process and by which you deliver a service or you deliver a product or you service the customer or you service the client is really important, because if the goal of the part of the business that operates the business doesn't keep the customer, then essentially you can lose the customer, and then the marketing, the efforts that sales and marketing now puts out is almost deemed, you know, useless. It's almost like it's like a leaky faucet, so to speak. You have all this water, but it's leaking out.
Interesting.
So that's a second part, how I kind of look at business. And then the third part, let's call that financial management.
Okay.
And that's the part of the business in which you kind of manage the money. So there's revenues that come in. And if you keep customers, then of course you continue to build revenues up, right? Because you need customers, and then you need to keep customers in order to kind of grow the revenues and grow the profits. But if you don't financially manage the company properly, then that could also be a problem, because then you're going to mismanage the money, and then you can't produce a profit without the proper financial management. So
okay.
The part of financial management looks at the actual management of expenses, management of gross profit, management of the vendors, the whole administrative component of the business in addition to that as well. And that's what I kind of see as financial management. So it's kind of like, you know, a dance between these three different phases. And each part of the business has to be strong in order to produce a profit and in order for you to grow as well.
Right. You know, and I think what often business owners don't realize is that, all right, you may be growing organically by improving your marketing, improving the sales, the operations are working well, you've got sound financial management. That's one way to grow. And another is to acquire a business.
Acquiring a business is part of the sales and marketing arena. It's actually a skill. It's a business development skill. And it's an actual, instead of going after marketing yourself for, you know, to potential customers,
mm-hmm.
you're basically marketing yourself and selling yourself to a potential seller. And you're the buyer. So it's a little bit of a different, but in order to make an acquisition or in order to implement business acquisitions as a successful strategy in developing your business, you probably have to market yourself to the marketplace. You have to let the market know that you're a buyer so that opportunities could arise. Other than that, because if you don't do that, then you're just basically waiting for opportunities to come by chance, and you're not really utilizing the strategy proactively.
Okay, so it's sort of like sitting around waiting for a date, but never actually going out and telling anybody that you're looking.
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly. So if you really want to be a buyer, if you want to be an acquirer, yeah, exactly. Especially from a man's standpoint, right? I mean, that's just, it'd be ludicrous just to sit around and wait for a date. If you want a date, you got to go and talk to women. And it's the same thing. If you want to acquire companies, you have to let the market, you have to let businesses in your industry or businesses that are similar to yours, you have to let people know, you have to let them know that you're an acquirer.
Okay.
And if they're interested in selling, that they ought to talk to you.
All right. So for people who may be saying, you know what, I don't know that if I necessarily want to build a whole new capacity in-house, but I might be looking to acquire, what are some of the steps in the acquisition process, just so we can get a sense of what's involved and the timeframes as well?
Well, I think the first and foremost, your house has to be strong first before you go out and acquire. The biggest mistake you can make is thinking that an acquisition is going to solve your problems. You actually have to be pretty strong yourself. The company has to be strong in order to go out and successfully acquire.
Okay.
If you're a sinking ship and you acquire a sinking ship, it's two sinking ships. and both ships will wound up sinking faster than they would individually sink.
Okay. So what are some of the indicators of a strong company to know that your house is really in order?
Well, I'm pretty basic, Nina. Are you profitable? You know, the business makes you a good living. All money is beyond the amount that it makes you. You know, like if you work in the business a certain amount of time, you have to compensate yourself for the services that you provide that company, right?
Mm-hmm.
All dollars beyond your compensation that you're able to distribute to yourself is profit. So if the business is profitable, I think that's an indication that the business is healthy. If the business is not producing profits, then the business is probably not all that healthy, although the owners might convince themselves that the business is a good business.
Mm-hmm. Well,
to me, I think it comes down to profits.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular ratios? So for example, let's say my company generates, $1 million, and mm-hmm. my expenses, I'm trying to make the numbers so that they're round and they're easy. I have $400,000 in expenses, and I'm paying myself $500,000. So we're making $100,000 in profit. Is that considered healthy?
Well, if you run the company mm-hmm. and you're working in the business 40, 50, 60 hours a week, your marketplace for a salary to run that company is probably not going to be $500,000. So to be a manager or a general manager or the main manager or the COO of a company, a small company, mm-hmm. $500,000 would not be a market salary.
Okay.
You know, it might be around $150,000. So if you're making $600,000, you know, maybe $150,000 could be the market salary for your services, and the balance is profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if you're making that $600,000 in profit, for instance, and you don't even work in the business, you show up like once a day or one day out of the week, or you're kind of working more on the strategic part of the business. You don't have to go physically day to day all the time.
Right.
You have more autonomy. I can argue that all $600,000 of that dollars that you collect is profit purely because if you sold the company, all the buyer has to do is maintain what you've built. The business is pretty much independently running without your day to day involvement. And that's the business that has the most value, because if the business is dependent on the owner, I can make an argument that the owner has a job, not a business.
Mm-hmm. And I know you have a wonderful quote or mantra, which is really that a business is truly a commercial enterprise that can function and works without the owner having to be an active and integral micromanaging part of it.
Yeah, the owner's a part of it, then it's not really a business. The owner owns a job. So how that plays out in the mergers and acquisitions arena is that when you go out to sell your company, the buyer is going to be reluctant to really give you any real value. And any value they do give you is a value that they'll pay over time, and it'll involve you having to stay in the business. And it doesn't really improve your position, that means, because if you keep the business, you have to run the business anyway. So if you sell the business, a lot of the compensation on the sale has to involve you working in the business. So it's almost like you sold yourself. You didn't really make any progress in that kind of sale.
Right. And then you're not your own boss anymore. You're listening to somebody else who may not have quite the same ideas about how to run your company as you did.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why it's critical to be able to develop a management team that can run your business while you are kind of more focused on the strategic growth and driving the direction of the company.
Okay.
And as a business owner, you can put yourself in that position, then you have a more valuable asset to sell.
Right.
But we talked about buying. So when you said the first step in my mind is, as a business, is to develop a successful business independently of any acquisition you make. And if your business is in strong shape, has strong financials, has strong profitability, you have a management team, then business acquisitions could be an explosive growth strategy because you already have a strong foundation. So then when you go to acquire, it's easier to go and raise money. It's easier to make deals. You also have less risk, right? Because you already have cash flow coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So when you make a deal, bringing in a new book of business to try to to merge it into your company, there's a lot less pressure when you already have a strong foundation. So I think that's step one. Build a business and develop your business that's successful so that you could capitalize on the opportunity that a business acquisition can give you.
Okay, great point. Thank you. So that's step one.
You know, step one.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important also to build a strong financial statement. So many businesses steal from themselves, and they don't really develop a financial statement that enables them to partners with a bank or to be able to raise money from investors.
Okay. And that's a powerful way to phrase it. They steal from themselves. What do you mean by that?
Well, the accountant is going to try to get you to pay as little taxes as possible on your tax return. And that's really the whole purpose of a tax return in small business. Some which are legitimate strategies, others which are a little borderline legitimate strategies. There is a little bit of a fine line of tax avoidance and, you know, tax
evasion,
you know, so there's like a little thin line between the two. But fact of the matter is that in public companies, when you notice that the financial statement is, you know, they're all audited financial statements, and the whole purpose of the financial statement is to kind of show earnings so that your stock prices rises, right? But in small privately held businesses, the purpose of the financial statement and the tax returns is to hide earnings and to make the business as little, is to show as little profitability as possible. But the problem is when you do that and then you go to a bank and you're asking for money, particularly for growth, right? You just got a bunch of new accounts and you need inventory. Mm-hmm. You just got a bunch of new accounts and you need now to pay new labor, right? You might need more equipment, you might need another facility. So you're growing and you need money to grow. And if you self-finance everything, then that's not, it's going to position you where you can't earn income. So then you try to go and you go to a bank for a line of credit, or you go to a lender, a private lender, and you can't get the money because when they look at your financial statement, it looks like you're not making any money. So I think one of the keys for a successful business acquisition is to have a strong financial statement so then you can go and raise the money to make the deal and to acquire another company. Because if you don't have a strong financial statement, then when you go and you try to make a deal with a prospective seller, you're not going to have any leverage. You're not going to have the resources to make the deal unless you save a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. So is there a point in the growth of a business where, you know, you get to a point where you say, all right, I know I've been trying to minimize my taxes and now I'm ready to grow up and put my big girl panties on and say, I understand that showing what I need to show is going to perhaps put me in a less advantageous tax position, but perhaps a more advantageous financial and investment position.
Well, I mean, you can demonstrate earnings and then take those earnings and invest those earnings in tax deductible and tax deferment vehicles.
Hmm.
You know, you have the various 401ks and IRAs that exist. You have other vehicles that exist that could enable you to ride off those earnings in a way where when you go and you go and you want money from a bank, the bank sees that money that you've essentially deferred or deducted for tax purposes mm-hmm. is still really earnings.
Okay.
And they consider it earnings. Although it may not be reflected, your profit number and the tax return might be zero. The lender will see you invested X dollars in this 401k, X dollars in this IRA, X dollars in this other tax deferment vehicle, and all that money is considered earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And then the salary that you pay yourself as an owner, that would be considered earnings. And then there's other lines in the financial statement where a bank would look at it and say, well, you know, that's earnings as well, as opposed to trying to skim off the top and not report all the revenues or some of the other things that a lot of businesses do to avoid taxes or try to drive the inventory number up when that's not the real true cost of goods number, but the accountant might be playing games with the inventory number in order to reduce taxes. And then the bank can't really see, you know, the bank doesn't see legitimacy in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you're saying a strong financial statement, it doesn't mean that you have to show, you know, millions of dollars in net profit, but there are certain things that they will look for, like owner's earnings, like, as you say, contributions to 401k and other tax-deferred vehicles, that they can sort of mentally build back into that number so that they see that you're in a strong financial position. Okay,
correct. And what building the financial statement does is that enables you to have a source of capital when you go after an acquisition, because then you could utilize the lenders as a way to make the acquisition, in addition to other sources of financing you might be able to, you know, tap into.
Right.
The misconception is that business owners have is that they need money to make a business acquisition. And that's actually not the truth. What they need is a strong financial statement combined with an experience, right? Because if what the financial statement does for a lender or investor is that it actually verifies or supports the notion that the owner's experience in this industry and can handle a business in this industry. And they're more willing to pull the trigger and give you capital as the owner to make the acquisition. So the financial statement is actual proof of that notion.
Okay, great. So we have our strong foundation in our own business. We have a strong financial statement as step two. Is there a step three?
Step three is now to develop a criteria to know exactly what you're looking for in the acquisition. Now, what you have to understand is what the value of an acquisition gives you. Now, for the most part, the main values is that it gives you a customer base, and it gives you income, and it gives you profit. But it also gives you other things. It could give you staff and labor that you need. It might give you new technology or the use of new technology that your company needs. It might give you access to other kinds of intelligence that you don't have. And I think you got to get clear on what you're trying to look for, particularly the kinds of customers. The most important thing you're looking for is new customers in an acquisition. And you have to know what kind of customers are attractive to you in order to determine whether an acquisition of a company is healthy. I also think you have to be very clear on what kind of people you're looking for in terms of staff or employees, because along with the business comes customers and staff and people. So
right.
I think you have to be clear what your culture is so you can determine whether the culture of the acquisition target is a good fit or not. Because the numbers might be able to work, but if the other parts, the other components, particularly your culture and how it relates to employees and customers, or your culture in terms of how it relates to how that potential acquisition target currently operates, if you're not clear on that, then it's hard to make a successful deal.
Okay. Can you give an example of where the cultures may have clashed?
Well, I'll give you an example would be, let's just say you have a company that sells a product or the way they kind of design their service is more like, for instance, it's project-based or it's based on time where you maybe charge an hourly rate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the acquisition target might be all their customers might be recurring revenue, where each client pays a monthly fee. There has to be the two entities should probably be able to be combined. So, for instance, if you're the buyer and you're the recurring revenue company and you're buying a company that sells their services on time and materials, it might be important to convert some of those customers and who are on time and materials to a more of a recurring revenue model.
Right.
I give you an example. Yeah, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. Well, I've dealt with companies where, you know, it might be a trucking logistics business, right, that issues terms in 2 weeks. But then the company they're trying to buy, they have customers that pay a whole lot later. They pay 30 days or 45 days or 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
So the culture is a little different in terms of how the business interacts with its customers. So if you have the same trucking logistics company who gives two-week terms, they work with customers who are either good payers or they have relationships in the selling process that emphasize payments on, you know, timely payments.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you've now acquired another company and all their customers pay 30, 45, 60 days. Well, clearly the culture and the relationships that business has with its customers is different from the one that the acquirer might have.
Right.
And you have to reconcile it. If not, it could affect the business going forward.
Sure. And also you have two different sets of staff working under two very different sets of assumptions in terms of what you do for collections and follow up with clients and things like
exactly.
that.
So it has to be some compatibility. Now, sometimes there's no compatibility, and then that doesn't mean you can't make the acquisition, is that you might have to keep the two companies separate and let them have two separate marketing identities, brand identities, mm-hmm. keep the staff separate. You can make an acquisition and keep the company separate and just have them in one, you know, have two separate divisions or have them, you know, interrelated in a holding company, you know, have them relate in that way, but they don't have to necessarily be integrated.
Okay.
And then there's other cases where it makes sense to integrate two companies because the cultures are similar and the management methodology is similar.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you this. Very often business owners will say, yeah, you know, we're generating on $1 million, $3 million, $5 million. And I should be able to sell my company for, you know, $30 million because it's, you know, it's a multiple.
All right.
I hear you snickering. and so what I'm wondering is whether there's just a general ballpark reality-based formula for calculating,
uh-huh.
you know, what do you think you're going to net when you sell your business? So that, you know, for people saying, yes, I would like to, but I don't know if I've reached the point where I'm going to get the most for my business, they know what they can work toward instead of working themselves, you know, almost into the grave and then they're, you know, on the verge of collapsing and saying, okay, now I need to sell, and realizing, oh, I'm only going to get $500,000 for my company. So that's where, you know, I wanted us to chat about how can we kind of do a thumbnail sketch of what can service business owners expect to receive once you've netted out everything from a sale, so they know, is that enough to live on or to move on to the next venture?
Well, I'm going to give you a real simple business valuation form. You know, business valuation is a complex subject.
Yes, I know.
And, you know, there are designations that you can go and get. And, you know, a lot of CPAs, you know, or some CPAs going, they get the various designations. And there's a whole wide range of reasons why one ought to get a business valuation. There's a wide range of reasons why someone gets a business valuation. But in the real world of buying and selling companies, there's, to me, I have a very simple formula how I kind of determine.
Right.
And so there are two components. There are two things that you have to consider when valuing a company. One is, what are the earnings of the business?
Mm-hmm.
And two, it's how transferable is the goodwill? So let's get into the earnings. To me, earnings is the profit that's after the owner's salaries. So if the business owner works in the business, he has a marketplace salary, right? And that's considered an expense. And any profits after that, you know, and you know, a lot of owners take out a lot of their personal expenses and they write it off from their business. So that kind of mm-hmm. if you take that out of the mix, and you come up with an earnings number after that. And, you know, the term that's used a lot is EBITDA,
mm-hmm.
you know, earnings before, you know, interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. But, you know, I like the word earnings because it's very simple.
Sure.
And to me, earnings, or you could also call it profit. But whether you call it earnings or profit, it's the number that's after the owner's salary. And that's like a number, right?
Okay.
And usually that determines the price of a business, because the buyer is usually going to pay a multiple of that number. And depending on how high the multiple is, that's going to determine the return on investment that the buyer receives. So if a business is producing $300,000 earnings and a buyer pays $900,000, right, then the buyer is going to receive, you know, a 30% return, more or less, 33% return. If he pays four times earnings, then he's going to get a 25% return. And if he pays five times earnings, he's going to get a 20% return. Normally, buyers are not going to go and buy a business and not at least get a 20% return. So that's going to be the lowest return typically a buyer would receive, unless a buyer can kind of create his own return, meaning you as a business makes 300, but because he's going to go and integrate your company into his company and cut all your expenses,
mm-hmm.
his earnings might be 500 or 600 after, you know, taking into account all the synergies that he capitalizes on in making the acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that case, maybe he'll pay a little bit more because he's going to make more. You know that. But in that, but just all things being equal, typically a buyer's not going to pay. He's not going to receive less than a 20% return, typically. And more often than not, he's going to be shooting for more of a 33% return.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's not unusual for a business to trade between 3 to 5 times earnings.
3 times. Okay.
But that earnings number is not, again, is a number after the owner, a marketplace salary for the owner.
Right.
And that's what usually throws this equation off, because a business mm-hmm. owner could be making $300,000 a year, but he's working 80, 90 hours a week and, you know, a market salary for all the work that he does, if you take into account all the stuff that he does, you know, out of that 300 profit, 200 of it is really just a salary. So right. then in that case, the profit's 100, and then he's selling mm-hmm. the company for on a multiple of that 100.
Okay.
So earnings to me is what determines the price. And what's important to understand is that those earnings have to be transparent in a financial statement. So again, if you have bad books and records and you're hiding your earnings and your earnings cannot be discovered by a buyer, then essentially the business has no value.
Okay.
So it's very important that the price is usually going to be determined by earnings, and those earnings have to be transparent. That's one part of the formula.
Okay.
The second part of the formula is how transferable is the goodwill? Called goodwill transferability. Now, what that is essentially is you have your earnings, and earnings says what the owner or what the business has been able to produce up to this point, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the concept of goodwill transferability states how transferable are those earnings to a third party. So, Nina, you might own this company. Let's just say the business is a food distributor. Hey, Nina, you own this food distribution company. It produces $5 million in sales, and it produces $500,000 in earnings. Let's just say that's the numbers.
Right.
But that's what Nina Kaufman is making. Now, when Nina sells to JC, the question becomes, is JC going to be able to produce $5 million with a $500,000, $5 million in revenue with $500,000 earnings? Can JC make that? And what are the risks in the business, in the transaction itself, that would prevent that from happening?
Okay.
Yeah, so what determines goodwill transferability, the risks associated with it could be, for instance, customer concentration. You know, needed out of those $5 million in sales, $2 million of them might be with one customer.
Mm-hmm.
So what if I buy the business and then you lose that account? Well, now I didn't buy a $5 million business. I bought a $3 million business.
Right.
Let's just say you have some concentration in products. Let's just say out of that $5 million, $3 million of them is based on some distribution deal you have on some sports drink in South America. You know, I'll just give you an example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That you import. And right now you have a distribution deal on that, but that distribution deal is expiring in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
What if you lose that distribution deal and you can no longer distribute that product? Or what if you don't have exclusivity no more? And there's other competitors that could also sell the drink. Well, that's called supplier concentration. And that's another example of a risk. Another risk would be salesperson concentration. What if I buy a company, Nina, and it's $5 million in revenues, $500,000 in earnings, but out of the $5 million, $2.5 million is produced by a salesperson who could technically leave at any time? What if that salesperson doesn't really want to work for me, the buyer, no more, and they take those accounts and they transfer it off over to a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
Did I buy a $5 million company, or am I buying something less because of the risks?
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, that's such an interesting point to hear you explain it that way, because for so many service businesses, it's the personal relationships that especially the owners have been able to generate with the customers that there isn't necessarily a guarantee that, you know, as wonderful as you may be, that the customer will feel quite as comfortable getting, maybe even it's exactly the same service from you that they got from me.
That's mm-hmm. another risk. Another risk is just that the owner is the business. and all the customer relationships are attached to the relationship with the owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are several other risks. Maybe new competition has just entered into the market and is affecting sales, or has already had a direct impact, and the projection is that that impact will continue. That's another goodwill transferability issue. There's a whole wide range of goodwill transferability mm-hmm. issues. So, you know, what if you have a line of credit and you depend on the business depends on that line of credit to go and buy inventory, but now what if because of the economic environment that line of credit is going to be cut down? Now the business doesn't have the resources to go and buy the inventory at a certain, you know, in a timely manner to be able to resell it to its customers. So what goodwill transferability is that it's a measure. It's a standard by which we measure what the risks of the deal are. And if the deal is risky, then what will happen is the price that's agreed to is usually going to be, it's going to be paid not in cash up front per se.
Mm-hmm.
So the stronger the transferability is, the less risk in the transaction, the buyer is going to take more risk and give more cash to the seller at the closing table.
Okay.
Whereas if the business has risks of the goodwill being transferred to the buyer, then the buyer and the seller might share some of those risks. So what does that mean? Well, that means that the seller is going to receive less cash at the closing and is going to receive a lot of the compensation over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be in the form of seller financing and a promissory note where you pay part of the purchase price to the seller with an interest rate, as if the seller is like the bank almost. Or it could be paid in the form of what we call an earnout, which means that part of the purchase price might be dependent on the future performance of the business, in which probably most likely the seller will stay on board as in some sort of managerial capacity and help with the client retention over time. And if the clients are retained or a certain level of revenue gets hit, then they get compensated a certain amount over time based on performance.
Right. And that, you know, and that's where we started the conversation by saying, if you want out and you want to make it clean, you know, you don't want to have such a long transition period because there are so many risks of, again, being an employee in somebody else's business, particularly after you've been your own boss for such a long time. So, JC, you've given us so much to think about. I mean, not only the three steps to making sure your business is strong, your own independent foundation, strong financials, know what you're looking for or what your acquirer is looking for in you, and really having a sense of your earnings and the extent to which your goodwill could be at risk, because all of those have a factor in how much you're going to walk away with and ultimately hang out on that island in Tahiti.
We're talking about from a buyer standpoint. So the reason why the business valuation formula is important is because if you're selling the company, then one of the things you have to prepare in your exit strategy is you have to make sure your financial statements clearly reflect your earnings. And of course, you have to make sure the earnings is at a certain level where it would make sense to sell. I like to use, most likely you're going to sell your business between 3 and 5 times earnings, unless your earnings are really big and you could find a strategic buyer who could achieve more earnings with your earnings because of the infrastructure that they have in place
mm-hmm.
and the synergy that's involved in a transaction. In that case, they would pay more than 3 to 5 times their earnings. I think it's also understand what earnings is. It's a profit number after you compensate yourself for the services you provide the company.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think they're making $300,000 a year, but they're working in the business, so they're not making $300,000 a year in profit. They're paying themselves a salary, and then the balance is the profit. So
right.
It's the profit in which it's the earnings. The profit number is what dictates the price. And then the goodwill transferability, I think, is important if you're trying to sell the company to kind of shore up a lot of those risks so that when you do sell the business, that the buyer is going to give you most of the money up front at the closing.
Oh, yeah.
And the buyer won't do that if there's, you know, the book of business that you're selling them has risks associated with it. And in that case, they're going to ask you to share the risk.
Okay. Terrific. Really, just a great recap. Thank you so much, JC, for being with us today and putting, really planting those seeds for us so that we have a sense when it's time to sell, what are the different pieces that we want to make sure are in place so that we can come away from that table with as much money in our pockets as possible.
Really appreciate it, Nina, for the interview today, and I look forward to hearing it as well.
Thanks so much. Hey, thanks for listening. Remember, go over to businessexponential.com right now and download our 10 steps to a $1 million business. We lay it out for you step by step, the 10 building blocks that'll have you building and growing your business so it's not so dependent on you. Won't that be a relief? Of course it will. So do it right this minute so you don't forget. You'll see it there on top of the homepage. Go to businessexponential.com.